Welcome to the Futile Podcast tonight. It's Ian.
And Danielle.
And we're going to talk about Legend from 1985.
Five.
Good.
Yeah.
You're on it.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, we're talking about the theatrical cut, which is the Tangerine Dream score, and I think is a few minutes shorter. I'm not sure. Last time I watched this, I think I watched the director's cut.
Has some cool scenes. I think kind of ties it together a little bit better.
The director's cut? Yeah, I was thinking that too on this time watching the theatrical. It felt a little like a vignette of something, and then like, what's going on? Where are they? How are they here? It moves in a weird kind of like stop-start way.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, I don't know. I mean, my experience with this movie is I saw this movie when I was a little kid, like on a New Year's Eve, like, you know, with a couple other movies. And so I have kind of a weird nostalgia for it, I suppose. Which I don't think, I think what means like that it can only, like, upon newer viewings, I can only get so kind of critical of it. Because I like the design, I like the weirdness of it, and like kind of like it's dealing in familiar tropes, but it's also dealing in it's kind of its own thing. It's an original-ish sort of story.
It is, and I would say like the set is amazing, and the costumes and the characters are all like very whimsical and artistic and very well thought out. Like they all play their part really well, so you don't have to have a ton of characters in there, but everyone like fills in kind of like a void or a role that they need to play. But I have seen a version that is a combination of the two, because I feel that other people over time have felt like the theatrical version is missing something, and the director's cut is sort of, I mean, it's awesome, but it's just not the Tangerine Dream score.
Right.
So it's just not, it doesn't grab people, I think, in the same way. But they're all really awesome. It's like my favorite movie. Saw it when I was 4. Fell in love.
Oh, were you scared when you were 4 and you saw it?
I actually was not scared. I thought it was like the coolest movie I had ever seen. And it sort of captivated me. And I felt that it sort of transported me as like a 4-year-old into this other sort of realm, and did a really good job of it because it just seemed so real. And actually more now, I feel that it is actually really scary. And if I had kids, I probably wouldn't want them to watch that until they were older, because it is kind of like, it's kind of scary. There's some dark stuff going on in there, and the costumes are just done so well that,
right,
that could haunt your nightmares forever.
Yeah, it's talk about the design and all that. I mean, Ridley Scott is really, he came from that. I think he was doing that in advertising and stuff before his movies, especially those movies in the 80s, you know, early 80s, and here's early movies, Alien and Blade Runner, and this have, like, you know, definite attention to the aesthetic qualities in it. And there is a sort of a weird aspect of it where, like, you can kind of tell it's all sets. Like, they didn't go out in the woods and shoot this necessarily. And it gives it an artificiality, but it's done with such a sort of, like you said, dreamy quality. And
it's very tactile.
Yeah.
Like, they definitely put a lot of effort into it, but it doesn't all quite mesh. Like, it's not a real place.
Right, no, for sure. Like, it's a magical place, and kind of existing in a bubble. Especially, certainly in the theatrical cut, I don't think that they give much. I think they maybe give a little more context to the world or whatever in the director's cut, but not even then, not that much.
Not that much, and I do know just from being obsessed with this movie that a part of the reason why is it became a different movie because that set burned down.
Oh.
And they had some film and everything locked in, but it was a tragedy, and they
what
lost
was the set?
Somewhere in Los Angeles, this whole huge set that they had been, you know, that they made, and they were growing and had birds and it plants and all this stuff.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was like super elaborate, like actual waterfalls that they had built and plumbed and done all this really amazing stuff to. And I guess something funny happened with their fans and the place burned down. They lost everything. And so they had to just kind of like make do with what they had and put a movie together, because they had spent so much time and money and energy into it, so
it makes sense that it seems kind of hodgepodge.
Because
they had just, they had these bits they'd shot, and it had, it's like if an actor dies in shooting a movie. In this case, the set died, huh?
Yeah, the whole set died, which is really sad. So I'm almost curious as to what would have been if it hadn't burned down.
Looking at like an original screenplay, maybe, and seeing what the whole story really was could be interesting.
Because it's still a really cool movie, but you can tell that there's sort of like pieces missing.
There's gaps and. Yeah, which, I mean, like you said,
they tie it together with humor.
Right.
I think, which works really well. Lighten up kind of that darkness.
Right.
Which is good, but I don't know.
Some of the humor is a little off and a little weird.
Like, it's a little old-timey.
Yeah. And then, like you were saying, you know, this idea that it could just be a, you know, a freaking fever dream for Lily.
Yeah, she was eating those biscuits. What were they laced with?
I don't know.
She started tripping, like, right away.
Pretty much, yeah. Maybe Jack's not even there.
Maybe he's not there. Maybe she's just screaming in the woods, just totally gone.
Jack doesn't do much, but he does sort of, you know, do a couple things. I mean, Lily is more, I would say, proactive as the hero of the story in a weird way. Jack gets the sword and then goes to rescue her, but, I mean, she created the problem, too, so she does get to kind of solve things somewhat. And then Jack just gets to wield a sword once or twice.
He gets to do his manly part.
Yeah, right.
But she gets to play the manipulation game just as well as Darkness does.
Yeah, Tim Curry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fun. You get the he's forlorn and lovelorn or whatever for her. And so then she pretty quickly, like, you know, because he's so scary and terrifying looking
really
and everything.
Is.
Yeah.
But he's so emo.
Yeah, and she pulls that out on him. And I like that part. I think that's some of the good humor, is that I was like, what? Almost, you know? she knows how to push his buttons and manipulate him in ways that are kind of amusing, for sure.
Which also leads me to believe that she's not so innocent after all.
Well, I mean, yeah, because she, you know, she goes to touch the unicorn and shouldn't have done that and all those things, yeah.
It takes skill to be able to manipulate someone, though.
Well, right,
she didn't just learn that on the spot.
Yeah, possibly. I think in the director's cut, they allude to her being, like, an actual princess, and there's a kingdom far off or that they're removed from or something. Yeah, I don't really remember a lot of specifics in terms of what they changed, other than the score. And a little bit there. Maybe there's more at that house with that woman, the only other human in the whole story.
I think there's a little bit there, but not much. And there's more with, like, the fairies. So there's more dialogue with the fairies and more riddles, which I kind of actually appreciate those riddles, because it makes those sort of older jokes and sort of kind of odd sarcasm make more sense. Where in, you know, the theatrical, it's kind of like, okay, well, that was weird and funny, I guess, haha. There's definitely, like, some riddles with Gump in the forest around that bonfire. And then it just kind of pulls everything together. And then there's even some dialogue with Meg in the swamp. And that stuff is great. And they don't have it in the theatrical version.
Oh,
and
right, yeah.
And it's too bad, because it's really funny.
Right, right. There's a lot more there, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I do remember that.
And it kind of... I feel like those little bits, they're probably only, like, maybe an additional minute. Just kind of really tie it together.
Yeah, it must have been a pacing thing.
Maybe. I would say, too, there's a little bit more... with the darkness and Lily in the other one.
I feel like there is.
There's quite a bit more conversation, and it kind of maybe makes more sense as to how she figures out how to manipulate him a little bit.
Right, yeah.
But I can't remember the specifics. There's definitely little things that you'll notice, like the fairy, there's like the little light that they have buzzing around. You'll notice like little like strings and wobbly unicorn horns kind of like little like, oops, well, that's what we've got.
The footage is what they got.
It's just kind of like, and little like the boom is kind of like you can see the shadow in some places, which is kind of a bummer. But if you can ignore those things, it's still a pretty amazing movie. I really like it. I'll still watch it over and over again, but yeah, I do think it's more scary now.
It's scarier now, and it's definitely a mood piece, to mm-hmm. be sure. I was surprised by the, I thought the theatrical cut, I knew it was shorter, but I was surprised by how quick it got moving. I think mm-hmm. because it's got a strange pacing, you know, like there isn't really a lot of a journey to the story. It's like some stuff happens in a couple places, then they get the weapons, and then they're in like the darkness's lair or whatever.
Yep.
Like a lot quicker than I thought.
They do take a surprising amount of time to show the pie tin scene where they're throwing them like frisbees. That scene seems to go on for far too long compared to other scenes. Like, it's like, why are you showing that like 15 times? We get it. We're doing a thing.
I got your Twitter open here, and I'm looking at the tweets you did when you were watching about how the tenderizer bar.
Oh, yeah, where they're tenderizing the flesh of the elves that they're preparing for the darkness to put in a pie.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like eating everyone and everything.
They're good eaters.
Just like looking really like a very volcano-y BDSM bar. Just like really intense with the like leather and the... everything, just all of it. It's pretty weird. It's very 80s. It's kind of hodgepodge.
It has a Mad Max Thunderdome mm-hmm. kind of quality in that, in some of those parts. Where
yeah.
Definitely. And then with the soundtrack and having like the pop songs and then mixed with the score.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird.
I think that's... Yeah, that must be... So that's just the nostalgia you have as a kid. You see something that's like... This isn't like other things, but it's... I think it's in that realm of, like, you see stuff that's for kids first, you know, as a kid, like cartoons and mm-hmm. other things, and then you start to get exposed to other things, things that are maybe a little more deep or a little more involved, and then you get to finally get exposure to, like, a movie like this, which is, like, essentially a kid's movie on some level, but it's got, like you said, darker themes and stuff. And it's just like, okay, this is like the young adult or the
visuals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that kind of is like, wow, this is actually like a proper like episode of the Gummy Bears that somebody just decided to go crazy with. You know what I mean? Like,
I definitely didn't get some of their sarcasm as a 4-year-old, definitely get it now. And it's just like, oh, okay, yeah. Like, just I've watched it probably 50 times in my life, and I pick up something new every time I watch it, which is kind of interesting. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, or I just didn't see it that way when I was watching it the other time.
Well, you saw it the 30th time and then forgot about it the 40th mm-hmm, and then remembered
possibly.
It.
There was a time when we only had a few VHSs at home, and that movie was on one of them. It got watched a lot.
You rode the wheels off that one, huh?
Yep. Yeah. That and probably like, what was it? Like Indiana Jones, any of those movies.
Those are good.
Even though that one is sort of more boring in comparison. It's definitely more artistic, though.
Well, right, yeah. It's all that stuff. It's like a big play because of the sets and because of the, mm-hmm. even the subject matter. It's almost like some kind of overblown school production or something.
I feel like they used a lot of glitter in this particular movie. And I feel like I remember hearing that everyone had glitter on them all the time during the film. It was like in their eyes and in their throats, and it was just glittertopia.
I hate glitter. I'm glad that's not a thing with people. That was a thing with
with
women for a while, where it was like, I'm going to put glitter on. It's like, no, don't do that.
Mica's a little different, but glitter's kind of sharp.
Yeah, it's little specks of, like, abrasive material, you know?
Yeah.
it's like sand or something.
Yeah, the whole time I watched this the other night, I just kept thinking, like, oh my god.
How miserable.
Their allergies. Yeah. Like, could they even see anything? Feathers and glitter and dust and plant particles and who knows what else
Maybe
was in there.
It didn't matter, yeah.
Maybe. It was probably hot because set lights, and they made look like super sunny in there. So it was probably freaking miserable, but
probably
turned out pretty
cool. Created something that's memorable that I think, I don't know if anyone can argue that it's a really good movie, unfortunately. Like you said, I think that having that fire probably certainly knocked him down a peg.
Mm-hmm.
But like a lot of these 80s movies that you have nostalgia about, you see them again later and later, and you kind of build it up in your head, and then every time you see it at a certain point, you kind of, maybe it diminishes it a little bit each time. For me, I think that might be the case of this, though it might be because maybe the director's cut is a little more cohesive or something.
Could be.
Like, I don't dislike anything about it necessarily. I mean, other than things we've talked about, but
I definitely, like, have way too many quotes memorized from that movie. Like, I have seen it enough to just be able to think about it and quote it in my mind, or say something off to someone and they're like, what are you even talking about? It's like, oh, you don't know this movie? Okay. Happens. But yeah, I feel like there's not even really a lot of dialogue.
No, it's just all delivered in sort of a,
like a play,
wispy kind of way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's movement, but it's sort of erratic, and then it's just kind of holding on visuals and close-ups and extreme close-ups of items and things. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit abstract in places.
It is.
And very moody, which is why it's interesting to me that the director's cut, Ridley Scott, you know, chose to go with the Jerry Goldsmith score, mm-hmm. which I remember being a little more generic.
Yeah.
And because so much of the theatrical cut, I think, with those more abstract scenes and slow motion moments and things, mm-hmm. really relies and really makes use of sort of supplementing that, or that mood, with the kind of unusual Tangerine Dream score that
it's more magical, you would
have liked it, but maybe he didn't. I don't know. Or maybe he just had what he had, you know?
Maybe he was just going with it. Yeah. It's hard to say.
Well, they were a popular enough group for a while. They did quite a few scores mm-hmm. for a couple different movies. Yeah. In the 80s, what are you going to do? There was just this, people just, like, we're going to make movies about stuff.
All sorts of stuff, and they were not going to be wearing much while they did it. They were going to wear a lot of glitter. They were going to be shiny, and they were going to be almost naked. It's awesome.
Oh, the fairy woman is almost naked, right?
She's almost naked. Tom Cruise, which his name is Jack again in mm-hmm. another movie. He's definitely kind of exposed in a few points. Lily is definitely exposed. Mia Sara.
Right. Yeah,
they're all just, and, you know, Gump, well, and
she's got Curry. The outfit, though, right? Like, it's a dress, I mean, but it's, like, but the way it V's down is pretty extreme.
extreme V. Yeah. It's pretty cool. That'd be a fun costume.
Really? You'd have to like, secure yourself pretty thoroughly.
Not me. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It's indicative of the 80s, people not wearing a lot of clothing, but being really, like, over the top with, like, big shoulder pieces and lots of glitter and
a lot of the post-apocalyptic stuff. Yeah. And things like that. Conan the Barbarian and Mad Max.
Making Tattered look kind of interesting and intriguing, but maybe not exactly beautiful, but it definitely catches the eye. But this was definitely not a popular movie for a lot of people. I would say maybe a handful of...
Got kind of a cult following.
Yeah, people I know have even seen this movie, let alone like the movie.
It does seem weird to me that there's kind of a... Because I feel like there's been sort of a resurgence even with people that are younger than us.
Mm-hmm.
And for movies like this, you know, now whether they're going after it for some kind of a hipster irony factor or not, I don't think there's a lot of room for that in this movie.
No. Which is maybe why it's not so popular.
Maybe, right, yeah, because it's like the parts of it that aren't good or that are flawed or that are problematic or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they don't lend themselves to being kind of fun in an ironic way. They're just kind of like, yeah, that isn't the best, you know?
Yeah.
But the parts that are good are good, but yeah. So you talked about this Midway cut. Do you remember anything? You said you've seen it. How did you see it?
I feel like it was the cut that my mother had recorded off of TV at some point. So that was what was on the VHS. And it was some combination of the two.
That's what they'll do for TV, yeah.
And it was like all the really awesome Tangerine Dream score, and then all the little tidbits with the elves and Meg, and just all the kind of all the dialogue that was right. missing, and they kind of put them all together, and it's honestly the best version.
I can see that.
It's like if they wanted to put those two movies together and make it one cohesive, kind of amazing
right.
feature.
That's probably what it is it's probably essentially the director's cut with the Tangerine Dream score, because then when he would go back to actually officially do the director's mm-hmm. cut, he would probably tweak some of those bits, but that probably gave... They've done this for TV before. It used to be a big thing. Back when they would show movies on like NBC mm-hmm. on a Sunday night and stuff like that, they would, you know, because they need to fit a certain runtime and movies don't always cater to that. There'd be situations where it's like, okay, we're going to remove some stuff or we're going to add, you know, some stuff. And yeah, you get like a, and always it makes me feel crazy because, another reason, right? I always,
we need those.
I always, feel like I remember, seeing you talking about quotes and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I always feel like I remember a certain way, and then I see it, and it's like the quote. The quote better. I came up with is the one that was better. Like they said it this way, right? And it's like no,
but
they didn't.
Already like that.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, when I first saw this, like the director's cut on DVD, I was like, wait, this is different. Like, where's that other part? And then I had to watch. I had to watch them both.
Right.
And then it made sense. I was like, okay, they combined the two.
Right.
Because I thought I was like having an aneurysm or something. Like, did I just make up these parts in this movie? I mean, it's possible. I have a pretty wild imagination, but still not that wild. Not to make quotes mm-hmm. like that.
Larger picture. Mm-hmm. The appeal of the movie to you, because you talk about it being like one of your favorites, like in your top 10 mm-hmm. or something
top
like
10.
That. Pretty definitively, you're not hemming and hawing on that.
No.
Do you have a... Is it the fantasy elements? Do you like those kinds of things? I mean, it doesn't seem like you're like playing Dungeons and Dragons, but just in talking with you and stuff, it seems like you like some of that stuff. You certainly like...
I definitely...
Are drawn to the aesthetics of, you know...
I would say...
The magical, whimsical...
I'm definitely into like magical, amazing... sparkly wildness, like the unicorns are awesome, and I don't know, it's just really not of this world and very eye-catching, and I think maybe I've always been kind of artistic even as a kid, and so the bright contrasting colors, and even just I'm very tactile with a lot of things, and just taking note of how long it took to maybe make those sets and the energy and effort put into it.
Right.
To kind of try to make it look real, but also to make it look outer worldly. Just, it definitely is not of anything you would see in your day to day, but it's not too terribly over the top. Like, it's kind of like, it's weird. It's like a mix of magic and kind of mundane. And I think that just from the get-go, I loved them. Like, I just knew that these movies were something I would always like, and growing up, I would watch them, and they were still awesome. They were a go-to, even though they're kind of dumb.
Well, this one is specifically with
and
the
honestly,
design.
Darkness is, like, the coolest character. Like, he's kind of, like, the most dynamic in a way, in the sense of, like, yeah, he's darkness and he's all evil and all of that, but he clearly is very alone and he's very lonely.
Right.
And he wants someone by his side, and he's so, like, forlorn about it. And he's just kind of a doof also.
Yeah.
Like, even though he's this evil guy, he's still just kind of like a bumbling idiot. But he looks terrifying. Like, he's awesome. Like,
yeah.
His character is, like... the epitome of Satan. Like,
yeah.
He looks so cool.
The giant horns is
and his
some
hooves and just
made,
the
yeah.
way that they, like, when he steps out of that mirror and
yeah.
his hoof crunches on the ground, it's just, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is, it's cool and it's scary.
The visuals were really, like, I don't know, they're just stuck in there as amazing. And
yeah.
maybe if I had seen this movie as an adult for the first time, I might feel differently about it, but I kind of don't think so.
Well, you said at 4, and even at 4, you were thinking about, like, the
I just knew that.
Design and
like
the,
I knew that like, it
artistry
wasn't
that went into it. You were thinking
real.
About it behind the scenes.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't a real place, and I knew that it had been created, and that someone had created that.
And you liked that,
and
you,
I liked it.
That's
like,
cool.
Someone went above and beyond. I was a weird 4-year-old.
No, but that's
I wasn't,
yeah.
I wasn't sitting around watching gummy bears. That shit was boring.
Oh. Gummy bears.
I know. Oh, I'm sorry.
You made fun of me for gummy bears. No. Yeah, we had a. I think we had a good bump of solid fantasy stuff in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't watch this, but I watched like 5 or 6 of them one weekend when I was sick with a cold. Like I watched like Willow and Time Bandits. I mean, I kind of stretched the definition a little. Like something like Time Bandits has got fantastical elements, but you got like the Conan the Barbarian ones. You got your sand and you got your sword and sorcery, and then you got your sword and sandal. You got like all these little weird subgenres. You haven't seen either of the Conan the Barbarian movies?
I've seen both of those.
Oh, okay, right.
But they're like I didn't see Willow until I was older, and then I sort of thought it was dumb.
You don't like Willow, or have you seen it again? Like.
I would have to watch it again. It's been a while.
I feel like there's a lot of things in Willow you'd like.
I know. It seems like my kind of thing.
Would somebody oversell it to you? Because
I
they're
think
like,
so.
You would love this. But now you're an adult and you see it.
And then
okay.
I was like,
That's
I
too
mean,
bad.
And then there's, you know, like the never-ending story
right.
and all of those things, which are also really cool, but they look a little hokey.
Yeah.
There's something about them that is, it's like, just a little bit off.
Yeah.
Whereas most of this stuff is set design and not really a lot of CG. I think with that early CG stuff, it just looked really bad.
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily CG, but it was the blue screens and things,
mm-hmm.
you know, Falcor and all of that and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some early visual effects type trickery.
Yeah.
And probably just didn't have, I mean, I don't know where it fits budget-wise, but I mean, and Wolfgang Peterson is a different kind of director than Ridley Scott, so you know he just didn't bring that care to detail with the visuals for that one. You got The Dark Crystal
mm-hmm.
and Labyrinth, a couple other ones.
Labyrinth is pretty awesome too.
Yeah, I haven't seen either of those in a while. That'll be fun.
Yeah, it's been a while. They're all really kind of dark but whimsical too. What was with the 80s? No wonder we're so screwed up.
Yeah, really. In a strange way, I feel like I could almost argue that the 80s is one of the best decades of cinema. Because it's got so much reckless... Not reckless. Well, kind of reckless.
Kind of.
But kind of unabashed, like, genre movies that people were just experimenting and doing weird
kind
things.
Of
I mean,
throwing
I think,
it out there.
I guess if you started...
watching it.
Yeah, if you started with, like, Star Wars in 77...
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the 80s in a very giant quotes thing, like 77 to 92 or something weird like
yeah.
that, you know, because then 92 you start getting this shift into these more indie movies and a little, you know, kind of like crime story stuff starts to come back and become more popular.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were it was definitely like an excursion into, you had your horror movies, like
mm-hmm.
your Nightmares on Elm Street and your Jason Slasher, Friday the 13th movies. You had, yeah, you had, you know, the last part of the Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
People trying to rip off Star Wars movies.
Oh,
I mean,
God, those are so bad.
Some of them are. Like, oh, you watched the one with the guy from the Waltons, the Mr. Science Theater, right?
Yes.
Was this Battle Beyond the Stars?
That was really terrible.
I don't...
It was
I've actually
bad.
Watched that movie. And, like, not Mr. Science Theater, and watched it. I remember it being... Because, like, the bones are good. Like, it's basically Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven.
They rip those bones off in a different movie.
Yeah, exactly. In space, which, I mean, like, could be pretty good. I mean, you've got all kinds of those things. Like, you have Outland with Sean Connery, which
mm-hmm.
is sort of like High Noon in space. You, things like Enemy Mine. I don't know if you've ever seen that one with Dennis Quaid and Louis Gossett Jr. where they're enemy pilots.
See that.
There's an alien and a guy and they both crash and it's basically, I mean, that's like the idea of that is like it's a science fiction action movie, but it's got like it's wrapped in this whole other idea of like two soldiers.
Just makes me
like,
think
yeah.
of what the hell was that movie he was in? Inner Space.
Inner Space, yeah.
Yeah. Meg Ryan.
We had, and Joe Dante had his heyday in the 80s with things like Inner Space and The Burbs and Gremlins
mm-hmm.
and Gremlins 2, The New Batch. And
yeah, and then you've got, you know, you got weird ones like Blade Runner.
Right.
And then kind of more sci-fi like that, too, which those were all really cool. I just feel like some were more cool than others.
Star Trek movies? Most of the Star Trek movies? Yeah,
most of Star Trek was pretty cool. Although hokey in its own way.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, they kind of were pretty self-aware about it.
I think so.
But yeah, there's all those, like, kids movies that are, like, dark fantasy. Yeah. Like, real dark.
They're still probably mostly PG-rated, but they're, like, they're just... The subject matter isn't completely...
They're not saying, like, swear words, really, or...
Or having graphic nudity, or anything.
Yeah, but it's still just like, whoa, everybody's dying, and it's the end of the world, and I have to do this thing, or else we all die.
Yeah, there's... That was definitely in the subtext, I think, of a lot of those movies, is mm-hmm. the Cold War fears of, you know, nuclear annihilation, and those things mm-hmm. were definitely... hitting in a certain way, and you could hear it in the pop music and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens with cinema now.
We're
sort of so stuck in this thing with comic book movies now, and this idea of a certain of the superhero as opposed to just like the regular type of hero or protagonist. Even
people don't even know what those are anymore.
Yeah, they really don't, and everyone thinks they're special. Mm-hmm. They're the chosen one or whatever.
Everyone wants to be special.
Yeah.
Some of us don't want to be special. Some of us just want to be normal.
Or just want to be us.
Just be... Yeah.
That's the lessons we learned from Legend. Just be you.
Just be you.
Be loved by the sun.
Yeah. Be true to your heart.
Yeah, true to your heart. And believe in love and trust. Mm-hmm. Trust Lily. Don't shoot her with an arrow.
Don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah. Maybe don't do that. Good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And don't forget to have a mutton rave in the BDSM Doom kitchen.
That would be fun. I could do that here. Like, I've got this house. It's got, like, a lot of wood and stuff. I lit it right.
Get all your fireplaces
all
going.
All fireplaces going and just do mutton rave.
Yeah.
Mutton rave 2017.
Just have lots of, like, that squealing noise in the background and steam. Lots of steam.
I could just, yeah, just the dryer vent. Just vents into the house anyway.
Oh, God. Sounding really ghetto.
Of course.
You have to get, like, some straw in here, though. Lots of straw.
It'd be pretty rotten. Let's see. I think I gave Legend, like, a 3.5 or something out of 5. I think that's my star rating for Legend.
I'm going to give it a 4.
4 out of 5?
Yeah.
It's one of your top 10, and it doesn't get a 5?
It doesn't get a 5 because they don't have the perfect version.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah. If they had the perfect version, then it would get a 5.
It's very magnanimous and objective of you.
Mm-hmm. With all the good quotes and words that make the whole movie go together. But it's a little disjointed. It's still fun. It's just not perfect.
Thanks for joining me. This was a fun one. But we're going to do more of these. We call these the sass casts.
Yeah, the sass casts.
Because you're the sassy one.
I think you're the sassy one. I think I'm pretty mellow on here right now.
I think we were both very mellow.
It's very mellow. This is the mellow cast.
Well, first we have to figure out when White Boy Day is, because we're going to talk about true romance at some point.
White Boy Day.
Yeah, and then was there another couple specific, anything else you'd think of? So you have a top 10.
I do have a top 10.
And so, you know, Legend is in, so we checked one of them off.
So Legend is one, True Romance is one. Fifth Element is another one.
Okay, we'll do that
you already
summer.
Know that Blade Runner is one of them. Oh my gosh, now I'm like, what are my other favorite movies? I really love Harry Potter, but like I have watched it way too many times. And right. I need to just like set that to the side a little bit.
We could have that would be the sass one.
Highlander is so good. I love that. Yeah, there's a list. I'll make a list. I'll make an actual list. And I'll email it to you.